Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents The Demon Cycle. Book 1, The Warded Man, Part 2. Created by Peter V. Brett. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by Karen Novak, Johan Detweiler, Joe Brack, Nanette Savard, Thomas Keegan, Yasmin Toison, Nick DePinto, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Stephen Carpenter, Mort Shelby, MJ Casey, Lily Beacon, Katie Karkoff, Colleen Delaney, Alyssa Wilmoth, Margie Tompros, Kimberly Gilbert, Ken Jackson, Ren Casey, Christopher Graybill, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Elizabeth Jernigan, Bradley Smith, Thomas Penny, Drew Copus, Casey Platt, Christopher Sheeran, Alexander Strain, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, and James Lewis. The Warded Man, Part 2.
There was smoke and fire.
I love you!
Roger's heart was racing. Dawn had broken over the high walls of Fort Angiers, soft light filtering in through the cracks in the shutters. He held his talisman tightly in his good hand as the light grew, waiting for his heart to still. The tiny doll, a child creation of wood and string topped with a lock of her red hair, was all he had left of his mother. He didn't remember her face, lost in the smoke, or much else about that night. But he remembered her last words to him. He heard them over and over in his dreams.
I love you!
He rubbed the hair between the thumb and ring finger of his crippled hand. Only a jagged scar remained where his first two fingers had been, but because of her, he had lost nothing else.
I love you!
The talisman was Roger's secret ward, something he didn't even share with Eric, who had been like a father to him. It helped him through the long nights, when darkness closed heavily around him and the quarreling screams made him shake with fear. But day had come, and the light made him feel safe again. He kissed the tiny doll and returned it to the secret pocket he had sewn into the waistband of his motley pants. Just knowing it was there made him feel brave. He was 10 years old. Rising from his straw mattress, Roger stretched and stumbled out of the tiny room. His heart fell as he saw Eric passed out at the table. His master was slumped over an empty bottle, his hand wrapped tightly around its neck as if to choke a few last drops from it. They both had their talismans. Roger went over and pried the bottle from his master's finger.
What's that?
You fell asleep at the table again.
Oh, stew boy. I thought it was that ripping landlord again.
The rent's past due. We're set to play small square this morning.
Rent. Always the rent.
If we don't pay today, Master Kevin promised he'd throw us out.
So we'll perform!
Roger went to help him up, but Eric pushed him away.
Now I'm fine! I could do a backflip.
We should save that for the performance.
You're probably right. My throat's dry. I need a drink before I sing.
Roger nodded, running to fill a wooden cup from the pitcher of water.
Not water! Bring me wine. I need a claw from the demon that called me.
We're out of wine.
Then run and get me some!
Eric stumbled to his purse.
Not a clat!
Eric gained his hands and knees by the time Roger got to him. But after a moment, he realized his master was sobbing.
Oh, it was never like this when I worked for the Duke. Money was spilling from my pockets then.
Only because the Duke paid for your wine.
Telling Eric he drank too much was the surest way to provoke him into a rage. He cleaned his master up and supported the heavy man to his mattress. Once he was passed out on the straw, Roger got a rag to clean the floor. There would be no performance today. He wondered if Master Kevin would really put them out, and where they would go if he did. The Angerian ward wall was strong, but there were holes in the net above, and wind demons were not unheard of. The thought of a night on the street terrified him. He looked at their meager possessions, wondering if there was something he could sell. Eric had sold Gerald's destry and warded shield when times had turned sour, but the messenger's portable circle remained. It would fetch a fair price, but Roger would not dare sell it. Eric would drink and gamble with the money, and there would be nothing left to protect them when they were finally put out in the night for real. Roger, too, missed the days when Eric worked for the Duke. Eric was loved by Rhinebeck's whores, and they had treated Roger like he was their own. Hugged against a dozen perfumed bosoms a day, they gave him sweets and taught him to help them paint and preen. He hadn't seen his master as much then. Eric had often left him in the brothel when he went off to the hamlets, his sweet voice delivering ducal edicts far and wide. But the Duke hadn't cared for finding a young boy curled in the bed when he stumbled into his favorite whore's chamber one night, drunk and aroused. He wanted Roger gone, and Eric with him. Roger knew it was his fault that they lived so poorly now. Eric, like his parents, had sacrificed everything to care for him. But unlike his parents, Roger could give something back to Eric. Roger ran for all he was worth, hoping the crowd was still there. Even now, many would come to an advertised engagement of the sweet song, but they wouldn't wait forever. Over his shoulder, he carried Eric's bag of marbles. Like their clothes, the bag was made from a jongleur's motley of colored patches, faded and threadbare. The bag was filled with the instruments of a jongleur's art. Roger had mastered them all, save the colored juggling balls. Roger had boots and gloves to match his motley, but he left them behind. He preferred the firm grip of his toes to the worn soles of his bell-tipped motley boots, and he hated the gloves. Eric had stuffed the fingers of the right glove with cotton to hide the ones Roger was missing. Slender thread connected the false digits to the remaining ones, making them bend as one. It was a clever bit of trickery, but Roger was ashamed each time he pulled the constrictive thing onto his crippled hand. Eric insisted he wear them, but his master couldn't hit him for something he didn't know about. A grumbling crowd milled about Small Square as Roger arrived, perhaps a score of people, some of those children. Roger could remember a time when word that Eric's sweet song might appear drew hundreds from all ends of the city and even the hamlets nearby. He would have been singing in the Temple to the Creator then, or the Duke's Amphitheater. Now, Small Square was the best the guild would give him, and he couldn't even fill that. But any money was better than none. If even a dozen left Roger a clat apiece, it might buy another night from Master Kevin, so long as the Jongleur's Guild did not catch him performing without his master. If they did, overdue rent would be the least of their troubles. Roger danced through the crowd, throwing handfuls of dyed wing seeds from the bag. The seed pods spun and fluttered in his wake, leaving a trail of bright color.
Eric's apprentice! The sweet song will be here after all!
Roger felt his stomach lurch. He wanted to tell the truth, but Eric's first rule of jongling was never to say or do anything to break a crowd's good mood. The stage at Small Square had three tiers. The back was a wooden shell designed to amplify sound and keep inclement weather off the performers. There were wards inscribed into the wood, but they were faded and old. Roger wondered if they would grant succor to him and his master, should they be put out tonight. He raced up the steps, handspringing across the stage and throwing the collection hat just in front of the crowd with a precise snap of his wrist. Roger warmed every crowd for his master, and for a few minutes he fell into that routine, cartwheeling about and telling jokes, performing magic tricks, and mumming the foibles of well-known authority figures. Slowly, the crowd began to swell. 30, 50. But more and more began to murmur, impatient for the appearance of Eric's sweet song. Roger's stomach tightened, and he touched the talisman in its secret pocket for strength. Staving off the inevitable as long as he could, he called the children forward to tell them the story of the return. He mummed the parts well, and some nodded in approval, but there was disappointment on many faces. Didn't Eric usually sing the tale? Wasn't that why they came?
Where is the sweet song? I came to hear a song!
Roger knew better than to oblige. His voice had never been strong, and it cracked whenever he held a note for more than a few breaths. The crowd would turn ugly if he sang. He turned to the bag of marbles for another option, passing over the juggling balls in shame. He could catch and throw well enough with his crippled right hand, but with no index finger to put the correct spin on the ball and only half a hand to catch with, the complex interplay between both hands when juggling was beyond him.
What kind of a jongleur can't sing and can't juggle?
He was better with the knives in the bag, but calling audience members up to stand by the wall while he threw required a special license from the guild. Eric always chose a buxom girl to assist, who, more often than not, ended up in his bed after the performance.
I don't think he's coming.
Many of the other crowd members were slipping away as well. A few tossed Glatz in the hat out of pity, but if Roger didn't do something soon, they would never have enough to satisfy Master Kevin. His eyes settled on the fiddle case, and he snatched it quickly, seeing that only a few onlookers remained. He pulled out the bow, and as always, there was a tightness in the way it fit his crippled hand. His missing fingers weren't needed here. Some of those that were turning away stopped to listen, but Roger paid them no mind. Roger didn't remember much about his father, but he had a clear memory of Jessam clapping and laughing as Eric fiddled. When he played, Roger felt his father's love, like he did his mother's when he held his talisman. Safe in that love, fear fell away, and he lost himself in the vibrating caress of the strings. Usually, he played only an accompaniment to Eric's singing, but this time, Roger reached beyond that, letting his music fill the space Sweet Song would have occupied. The fingers of his good left hand were a blur on the frets. Then he put his foot on one of the steps on the stage and pushed off into a backflip without missing a note. The sound broke his trance, and he saw the square was filled, with people even crowded outside to hear. It had been some time since even Eric drew such a crowd. He almost missed a stroke in his shock and gritted his teeth to hold on to the music until it became his world again.
Well, that was a good performance.
Roger counted the lacquered wooden coins in the hat. Nearly 300 clacks. Kevin would not pester them for a month.
Thank you.
Masters Jason and Edom stood before him. Guildsmen.
Where's your master, Roger?
Edom was a master actor and mummer whose plays were said to draw audience members from as far as Fort Rising. Roger swallowed hard, his face flushing hot. He looked down, hoping they would take his fear and guilt to shame.
I don't know. He was supposed to be here.
Ugh, drunk again, I'll wager.
Also known as Golden Tone, a name he was said to have given himself, Jason was a singer of some note. But more importantly, he was the nephew of Jansen, Duke Rhinebeck's first minister, and made sure the entire world knew it.
Old Sweet Song is pickled sour these days.
It's a wonder he's kept his license this long. I heard he soiled himself in the middle of his act last month.
That's not true.
I'd be more worried about myself if I were you, boy. Do you know the penalty for collecting money for an unlicensed performance?
Roger paled. Eric could lose his license over this. If the guild brought the matter to the magistrate as well, they could both find themselves chopping wood with chained ankles.
Don't worry, boy. So long as the guild has its cut...
Edom helped himself to a large portion of the wooden coins Roger had collected.
Ah, I don't think we need to make any further note of this incident.
Roger knew better than to protest as the men divided and pocketed over half the take. Little, if any, would actually find its way to the coffers of the Jongleur's Guild.
You've got talent, boy. You might want to consider a master with better prospects. Come see me if you tire of cleaning up after old Sour Song.
Roger's disappointment only lasted until he shook the collection hat. Even half was more than he had ever hoped to make. He hurried back to the inn, pausing only to make a single stop. He made his way to Master Kevin, whose face was a thunderhead as the boy approached.
He'd better not be here to beg for your master, boy.
Roger shook his head, handing the man a purse.
My master says there's enough there for a 10-day.
Kevin's surprise was evident as he hefted the bag. He hesitated a moment, then pocketed the purse with a shrug. Eric was still asleep when he returned. Roger knew his master would never realize the innkeep had been paid. He would avoid the man assiduously and congratulate himself on making it 10 days without paying. He left the few remaining coins in Eric's purse. He would tell his master he had found them loose in the bag of marvels. It was rare for that to happen since money became tight, but Eric wouldn't question his fortune once he saw what else Roger had bought. Roger placed the wine bottle by Eric's side as he slept. Eric was up before Roger the next morning, checking his makeup in a cracked hand mirror. He wasn't a young man, but neither was he so old that the tools in the jongleur's paint box couldn't make him look so. His long sun-bleached hair was still more gold than gray, and his brown beard, darkened with dye, concealed the growing wattle beneath his chin. The paint matched his tanned skin so closely that the wrinkles around his blue eyes were all but invisible.
We got lucky last night, my boy, but we can't avoid Kevin forever. That hairy badger will catch us sooner or later, and when he does, I'd like more than 6 clats to our name. Have you been at your juggling, boy?
Before Roger could open his mouth to reply, Eric flicked one of the clats his way. Roger was wise to the ruse, but ready or not, he felt a stab of fear as he caught the coin in his left hand and tossed it up into the air. More coins followed in rapid succession, and he fought for control as he caught them with his crippled hand and tossed them to the other to be put into the air again. By the time he had 4 coins going, he was terrified. When Eric added a 5th, Roger had to dance wildly to keep them all moving. Eric thought better of tossing the 6th and waited patiently instead. Sure enough, Roger fell to the floor in a clatter of coins a moment later.
Put your gloves on. We need to go out and fill our purse.
Eric's sigh cut even deeper than a shout and a cuff on the ear. Anger meant Eric expected better. A sigh meant his master had given up.
No.
What?
The gloves, I mean.
Eric's expression changed from anger to curiosity.
I don't want to wear them anymore. I hate them.
Didn't we agree that people would be less likely to hire you if they knew your infirmity?
We never agreed. You just told me to start wearing the gloves one day.
Hate to disillusion you, boy, but that's how it is between masters and apprentices. No one wants a crippled jungler.
So that's all I am? A cripple?
Oh, of course not. I wouldn't trade you for any apprentice in Angiers. But not everyone will look past your demon scars to see the man within. They will label you with some mocking name, and you'll find them laughing at you and not with.
I don't care. The gloves make me feel like a fraud, and my hand is bad enough without the fake fingers making it clumsier. What does it matter why they laugh if they come and pay clats to do it?
Let me see the gloves.
They were black and reached halfway up his forearm. Bright-colored triangles of cloth were sewn to the ends with bells attached. Roger tossed them to his master with a frown. Eric caught the gloves, looked at them for half a moment, and then tossed them out the window.
Grab your boots and let's go.
Eric tossed back the remains of his cup.
I don't really like the boots either.
Don't push your luck.
Guild law allowed licensed junglers to perform on any street corner so long as they did not block traffic or hinder commerce. Some vendors even hired them to attract attention to their booths or the common rooms of taverns. Eric's drinking had alienated most of the latter, so they performed in the street. Eric was a late sleeper, and the best spots had long since been staked out by other jongleurs. The space they found wasn't ideal, a corner on a side street far from the main lanes of traffic.
It'll do. Drum up some business, boy, while I set up.
Roger nodded and ran off. Whenever he found a likely cluster of people, he cartwheeled by them or walked by on his hands.
Jongleur show! Come see Eric's sweet song perform!
Between his acrobatics and the weight still carried by his master's name, he drew a fair bit of attention. Some even followed him on his rounds. One man elbowed his wife.
Look, it's the cripple boy from Small Square.
Are you sure?
Just look at his hand.
Roger pretended not to hear, moving on in search of more customers. He soon brought his small following to his master, finding Eric juggling a butcher knife, a meat cleaver, a hand axe, a small stool, and an arrow in easy rhythm.
And here comes my assistant, Roger Halfgrip.
Roger was already running forward when the name registered. What was Eric doing? It was too late to slow, though, so he put his arms out and flung himself forward, cartwheeling into a triple backflip to stand a few yards from his master. Eric snatched the butcher knife from the deadly array in the air before him and flicked it Roger's way. Fully expecting the move, Roger went into a spin, catching the blunt and specially weighted knife easily in his good left hand. As he completed the circuit, he uncoiled and threw, sending the blade spinning right at Eric's head. Eric, too, went into a spin and came out of the circuit with the blade held tightly in his teeth.
Roger Halfgrip, with only 10 years and 8 fingers, he's still deadlier with a knife than any grown man.
Roger held his crippled hand up for all to see. Already, Eric's suggestion had most of them believing he made that catch and throw with his crippled hand. They would tell others and exaggerate in the telling. Rather than risk Roger being labeled by the crowd, Eric had labeled him first.
Roger Halfgrip.
Roger turned as his master flung the arrow at him. He slapped his hands together, catching the missile just before it struck his face. He spun again, putting his back to the crowd. With his good hand, he threw the arrow between his legs back towards his master. And when he finished the move and faced the crowd, his crippled right hand was extended. Eric feigned fear, dropping the blades he was juggling. But the stool fell into his hands just in time for the arrow to stick in its center. Eric studied it as if amazed at his own good fortune. He flicked his wrist as he pulled the arrow free, and it became a bouquet of flowers, which he bestowed upon the prettiest woman in the crowd. More coins clattered into the hat. Seeing his master moving on to magic, Roger ran up to the bag of marbles for the implements Eric would need for his tricks.
Play your fiddle!
In the mood for music, are we?
Eric went to the bag and took the fiddle, tucking it under his chin and turning back to the audience.
Not you! The boy! Let Halfgrip play!
Oh, of course! You want the boy to play so I can sing!
Eric looked to Roger, his face a mask of irritation. Finally, he shrugged, handing his apprentice the instrument. Roger took the fiddle with shaking hands. Never upstage your master was a rule apprentices learned early. But the crowd was calling for him to play. And again, the bow felt so right in his crippled hand, free of the cursed glove. He closed his eyes, feeling the stillness of the strings under his fingertips. A fiddle came alive in his hands then, and he let it out like a partner in a reel, sweeping it into a whirlwind of music. He forgot the crowd. He forgot Eric. He had no idea how long it went on. He could have stayed in that world forever. He shook his head to clear it and looked up at the wild-eyed and silent crowd.
String broke.
Roger glanced at his master, who stood in the same shock as the other onlookers. Eric raised his hand slowly.
You're going to make us rich with that fiddling, boy.
Eric was counting their take.
Rich!
Rich enough to pay back the dues you owe the guild.
They turned to see Master Jason leaning against the wall. His two apprentices, Sally and Abram, stood close by. Sally sang soprano with a clear voice as beautiful as she was ugly. Eric sometimes joked that if she wore a horned helmet, audiences would mistake her for a rock demon. Abram sang bass, his voice a deep thrum that made the plank streets vibrate. He was tall and lean, with gigantic hands and feet. If Sally was a rock demon, he was surely a wood. Like Eric, Master Jason was an alto, his voice rich and pure. He wore expensive clothes of fine blue wool and gold thread, spurning the motley that most of his profession wore. His long black hair and mustache were oiled and meticulously groomed. Jason was a man of average size, but that made him no less dangerous. He had once stabbed a jongleur in the eye during an argument over a particular corner. The magistrate ruled it self-defense, but that wasn't how the talk in the apprentice room of the guildhouse told it. Jason's uncle Jansen was first minister of Angiers. In the palace, his voice was second only to the Duke's. On the streets, it was an open secret that a percentage of every thief and cutpurse's take made its way up to him.
The payment of my guild dues is no concern of yours, Jason.
Your apprentice may have talked your way out of missing that performance yesterday, Sour Song, but his fiddle can't sucker you forever.
As he spoke, Abram snatched Roger's fiddle from his hand and broke it over his knee.
Sooner or later, the guild will have your license.
The guild would never give up Eric's sweet song. But even if they did, Jason would still be known as Second Song.
Jason scowled, for many in the guild already used that name, and the master was known to fly into rages at its utterance. He and Sally advanced on Eric, who held the bag protectively. Abram backed Roger against the wall, keeping him from going to his master's aid. But this wasn't the first time they had needed to fight to defend their take. Roger dropped straight down on his back, coiling like a spring and kicking straight up.
I thought your apprentice was a bass, not a soprano.
When Jason and Sally spared a glance to their companion, Eric's quick hands darted into the bag of marbles, sending a fistful of wing seeds spinning in the air before them. Jason lunged through the cloud, but Eric sidestepped and tripped him easily. Brought the bag around in a hard swing at Sally. She fell hard, and before the three could recover, Eric and Roger ran off down the boardwalk. The roof of the Duke's library in Milne was a magical place for Arlen. On a clear day, the world spread out below him, a world unrestrained by walls and wards, stretching on into infinity. It was also the place where Arlen first looked at Mary and truly saw her. His work in the library was nearly complete, and he would soon be returning to Cobb's shop. He watched the sun play over the snow-capped mountains and fall on the valley below, trying to memorize the sight forever. And when he turned to Mary, he wanted to do the same for her. She was 15, and more beautiful by far than mountains and snow. Mary had been his closest friend for over a year, but Arlen had never thought more of her than that. Now, seeing her limbed in golden sunlight, cold mountain wind blowing the long brown hair from her face as she hugged her arms against the swell of her bosom to ward off the chill, she was suddenly a young woman, and he a young man. His pulse quickened at the way her skirts flared in the breeze, edges of lace hinting at petticoats beneath. He said nothing as he stepped forward, but she caught the look in his eyes and smiled.
It's about time.
He reached out, tentatively, and traced the back of his hand down her cheek. She leaned into the touch, and he tasted her sweet breath. It was soft at first, hesitant, but it deepened as she responded, becoming something with a life of its own, something hungry and passionate, something that had been building inside him for over a year without his knowing. Sometime later, their lips parted, and they smiled nervously. Arms around one another, they looked out over Milne, sharing in the glow of young love.
What do you want from life, Arlen? What do you dream?
A dream of freeing the world from the Corlings.
She did not mean to be cruel, but the sound cut at him like a lash.
You think yourself the deliverer, then? And how will you do this?
Arlen drew away from her a little, feeling suddenly vulnerable.
I don't know. I'll start by messaging. I've already saved enough money for armor and a horse.
That will never do if we're to marry.
Well, we're to marry?
What, am I not good enough?
Oh, no, I never said.
Well then, messaging may bring money and honor, but it's too dangerous, especially once we have children.
Wait, we're having children now?
Mary looked at him as if he were an idiot. She went on, ignoring him as she thought things through.
Nope, it will never do. You'll need to be a warder, like Cobb. You'll still get to fight demons, but you'll be safe with me, instead of riding down some Corling-infested road.
I don't want to be a warder. It was never more than a means to an end.
What end? Lying dead on the road?
No, that won't happen to me.
What will you gain as a messenger that you can't as a warder?
Escape.
Mary fell silent. She turned her head to avoid his eyes, and after a few moments, flipped her arm from his. She sat quietly, and Arlen found sadness only made her more beautiful still.
Escape from what? From me?
No, not you. Never you.
I have assignment to Harden's Grove.
Reagan was referring to a small farming hamlet a full day's ride from Fort Milne.
Would you care to join me, Arlen?
Reagan, no!
Arlen, may I have a moment alone with my wife?
If you'll excuse me.
Reagan closed the door after him, but Arlen refused to let his fate be decided out of his hands and circled around through the kitchen, listening at the servant's entrance.
He's too young!
Lissa, he'll always be too young for you. Arlen is 16, and he's old enough to make a simple day trip.
You're encouraging him.
You know full well Arlen needs no encouragement from me.
Enabling him, then. He's safer here.
He'll be safe enough with me. Isn't it better that he makes his first few trips with someone to supervise him?
I'd rather he not make his first few trips at all. If you cared about him, you'd feel the same.
Night, Lissa. It's not like we'll even see a demon. We'll reach the grove before sunset and leave after sunrise. Regular folk make the trip all the time.
I don't care. I don't want him going.
It's not your choice.
I forbid it!
You can!
Just you watch me. I'll drug your horses. I'll chop every spear in two. I'll throw your armor in the well to rust.
Take away every tool you want, and Arlen and I will still leave for Harden's Grove tomorrow on foot if need be.
I'll leave you.
What?
You heard me. Take Arlen out of here and I'll be gone before you get back.
You can't be serious.
I've never been more serious in my life. Take him and I go.
Look, Lissa. I know how upset you've been that you haven't gotten pregnant.
Don't you dare bring that into this.
Arlen is not your son. No amount of mothering will ever make it so. He is our guest, not our child.
Of course he's not our child. How could he be when you're out delivering ripping letters whenever I cycle?
You knew what I was when you married me.
I know, and I'm realizing that I should have listened to my mother.
Oh, what's that supposed to mean?
It means I can't do this anymore. The constant waiting, wondering if you'll ever come home. The scars you claim are nothing. The praying that the scant few times we make love will conceive before I'm too old. And now this. I knew what you were when we married, and I thought I had learned to handle it. But this... Reagan, I just can't bear the thought of losing you both. I can't.
A hand rested on Arlen's shoulder. Margaret stood there, a stern look on her face.
You shouldn't be listening to this.
Arlen felt ashamed for his spying. He was about to leave when he caught the messenger's words.
All right. I'll tell Arlen he can't come and stop encouraging him.
Really?
I promise. And when I get back from Harden's Grove, I'll take a few months off and keep you so fertilized that something can't help but grow.
Oh, Reagan.
You're right. I had no right to listen to that. But they had no right to discuss it in the first place.
He went up to his room and began packing his things. Better to sleep on a hard pallet in Cobb's shop than in a soft bed that came at the cost of his right to make his own decisions. For months, Arlen avoided Reagan and Alyssa. They stopped by Cobb's shop often to see him, but he was not to be found. They sent servants to make overtures, but the results were the same. Without use of Reagan's stable, Arlen bought his own horse and practiced riding in the fields outside the city. Mary and Jake often accompanied him, the three of them growing closer. Mary frowned upon the practice, but they were all still young, and the simple joy of galloping a horse about the fields drove other feelings away. Arlen worked with increasing autonomy in Cobb's shop, taking calls and new customers unsupervised. His name became known in warding circles, and Cobb's profits grew. He hired servants and took on more apprentices, leaving the bulk of their training to Arlen. One morning, when Cobb was away from the shop, Alyssa paid a visit. Arlen, busy talking to a customer, didn't notice her until it was too late.
Hello, Arlen.
Hello, Lady Alyssa.
There's no need to be so formal.
I think informality confused the nature of our relationship. I don't want to repeat the error.
I've apologized again and again, Arlen. What will it take for you to forgive me?
Mean it.
I do.
You don't. You're sorry that I overheard and took offense. You're sorry that I left. The only thing you're not sorry about is what you did, making Reagan refuse to take me.
It's a dangerous trip.
I've made the trip a dozen times in the last 6 months.
Arlen!
I've been to the Duke's Mines as well, and the South Quarries, everywhere within a day of the city. I've made my circles, and the Messenger's Guild's been courting me ever since I gave them my application, taking me wherever I want to go. You've accomplished nothing! I won't be caged, Alyssa. Not by you, not by anyone.
I never wanted to cage you, Arlen. Only to protect you.
That was never your place.
Perhaps not, but I only did it because I care. Because I love you.
Arlen paused, refusing to look at her.
Would it be so bad, Arlen? Cobb isn't young, and he loves you like a son. Would it be such a curse to take over his shop and marry that pretty girl I've seen you with?
I'm not going to be a warder. Not ever.
What about when you retire, like Cobb?
I'll be dead before then.
Arlen! What a terrible thing to say!
Why? It's the truth. No messenger keeps working and manages to die of old age.
But if you know it's going to kill you, then why do it?
Because I'd rather live a few years knowing I'm free than spend decades in a prison.
Milne is hardly a prison, Arlen.
It is! We convince ourselves that it's the whole world, but it isn't. We tell ourselves that there's nothing out there that we don't have here, but there is. Why do you think Reagan keeps messaging? He has all the money he could ever spend.
Reagan is in service to the Duke. He has a duty to do the job because no one else can.
There are other messengers, Alyssa. And Reagan looks at the Duke like he was a bug. He doesn't do it out of loyalty or honor. He does it because he knows the truth.
What truth?
That there's more out there than there is in here.
I'm pregnant, Arlen. Do you think Reagan will find that somewhere else?
Congratulations, I know how much you wanted it.
That's all you have to say?
I suppose you'll expect Reagan to retire, then. A father can't risk himself, can he?
There are other ways to fight demons, Arlen. Every birth is a victory against them.
You sound just like my father.
As long as she had known Arlen, he had never spoken of his parents.
He sounds like a wise man.
He wasn't wise! He was a coward! He let my mother die! He let her die!
His face screwed up into an anguished grimace and he stumbled, clenching his fists. Alyssa rushed to him, not knowing what to do or say, only knowing that she wanted to hold him.
He let her die. because he was scared of the night.
Harlan tried to resist her as her arms encircled him, but she held on tightly as he wept. She held him a long time, stroking his hair.
Come home, Harlan.
Harlan spent the last year of his apprenticeship living with Reagan and Alyssa, but the nature of their relationship had changed. He was his own man now, and not even Alyssa tried to fight it any longer. To her surprise, her surrender only brought them closer. Harlan doted on her as her belly grew, he and Reagan scheduling their excursions so that she was never alone. Harlan also spent a great deal of time with Alyssa's herb gatherer midwife. Reagan said a messenger needed to know something of a gatherer's art, so Harlan sought plants and roots that grew beyond the city walls for the woman, and she taught him something of her craft. Reagan stayed close to Milne in those months, and when his daughter, Maria, was born, he hung up his spear for good. He and Cobb spent that entire night drinking and toasting. Harlan sat with them, but he stared at his glass, lost in thought.
We should make plans.
Mary and Harlan walked to her father's house.
Plans?
For the wedding, Goose! My father would never let me marry an apprentice, but he'll speak of nothing else once you're a warder.
Messenger.
Oh, it's time to put your trips aside, Harlan. You'll be a father soon.
What has that got to do with it? Lots of messengers are fathers.
I won't marry a messenger. You know that. You've always known.
Just as you've always known, that's what I am. Yet, here you are.
I thought you could change. I thought you could escape this delusion that you're somehow trapped, that you need to risk your life to be free. I thought you loved me.
I do.
But not enough to give this up. How can you love me and still do this?
Reagan loves Alyssa. It's possible to do both.
Alyssa hates what Reagan does. You said so yourself.
And yet they've been married 15 years.
Is that what you condemn me to? Sleepless nights alone, not knowing if you'll ever come back, wondering if you're dead or if you've met some minx in another city.
That won't happen.
You're damn right it won't. I won't let it. We're done.
Mary, please.
We have nothing more to say.
Mary whirled and ran off towards her father's house. Harlan stood there a long time, staring after her. The shadows grew long, and the sun dipped below the horizon, but still he stood, even at last bell. He shuffled his boots on the cobbled street, wishing the corlings could rise through the worked stone and consume him.
Harlan! Creator, what are you doing here?
Alyssa rushed to him as he entered the manse.
When the sun went down, we thought you were staying at Cobb's.
I just needed some time to think.
Outside in the dark?
The city is warded. There were no corlings about.
Harlan, what's happened?
I told Mary what I told you. She didn't take it as well.
I don't recall taking it very well myself.
And there you'll find my meaning.
Harlan went to his room and threw open the window, breathing the cold night air and looking out into the darkness. In the morning, he went to see Guildmaster Malcolm. The next morning, Alyssa went out into the city before her husband awoke. Reagan would reprimand her for meddling, but Alyssa knew that Harlan was teetering on an edge, and she would not let him fall because she failed to act. She glanced about, fearing that Harlan might see her as she entered the library. She didn't find Mary in any of the cells or stacks, but was hardly surprised. Like many of the things personal to him, Harlan did not speak of Mary often, but Alyssa listened intently when he did. She knew there was a place that was special to them, and knew the girl would be drawn there. Alyssa found Mary on the library's roof, weeping.
Oh, Mother Alyssa, you startled me.
I'm sorry, dear. If you want me to go, I will. But I thought you might need someone to talk to.
Did Harlan send you?
No. But I saw how upset he was, and knew it must be as hard for you.
He was upset?
He wandered the streets in the dark for hours. I was worried sick.
Determined to get himself killed.
I think it's just the opposite. I think he's trying desperately to feel alive.
Mary looked at her curiously, and she sat down next to the girl.
For years, I could not understand why my husband felt the need to wander far from home, staring down corlings and risking his life over a few parcels and papers. He'd made money enough to keep us in luxury for two lifetimes. Why keep at it? People describe messengers with words like duty, honor, and self-sacrifice. They convince themselves that this is why messengers do what they do.
It's not?
For a time, I thought it was. But I see things more clearly now. There are times in life when we feel so very alive that when they pass, we feel diminished. When that happens, We'll do almost anything to feel so alive again.
I've never felt diminished.
Neither had I. Not until I became pregnant. Suddenly, I was responsible for a life within me. Everything I ate, everything I did affected it. I had waited so long that I was terrified of losing the child, as many women my age do.
You're not so old.
I could feel Maria's life pulsing within me, and mine pulsing in harmony. I'd never felt anything like it. Now, with the baby born, I despair I might never feel it again. I cling to her desperately, but that connection will never be the same.
What does this have to do with Arlen?
I'm telling you how I think messengers feel when they travel. For Regan, I think that the risk of losing his life made him appreciate how precious it is, and sparked an instinct in him that would never allow him to die. For Arlen, it's different. The Corlings have taken a lot from him, Mary, and he blames himself. I think deep down, he even hates himself. He blames the Corlings for making him feel that way, and only in defying them can he gain peace.
Oh, Arlen.
But he loves you. I hear it when he talks about you. I think sometimes, when he's busy loving you, he forgets to hate himself.
How have you done it, Mother? How have you managed to endure all these years, married to a messenger?
Because Regan is kind-hearted and strong at the same time. And I know how rare that kind of a man is. Because I never doubted that he loved me and would come back. Most of all, because the moments I had with him were worth all the ones apart. Give him something to come home to, Mary. And I think Arlen will learn that his life is worth something after all.
I don't want him to go at all.
I know. Neither do I. But I don't think I can love him less if he does.
Neither can I.
Arlen was waiting that morning when Jake left for the mill. He had his horse with him, a bay courser with a black mane named Dawn Runner, and his armor on.
What's this? Off to Harden's Grove?
And beyond. I have a commission from the guild to take a message to Lacton.
Lacton? It'll take you weeks to get there.
You could come with me.
What?
As my jongleur.
Arlen, I'm not ready.
Cobb says you learn things best by doing them. Come with me. We'll learn together. Do you want to work in the mill forever?
The milling's not so bad.
You take care of yourself, Jake.
When will you be back?
I don't know. Maybe. Never.
Alyssa and Mary returned to the manse later that morning to wait for Arlen's return.
Don't give in too easily. You don't want to give all your power away. Make him fight for you, or he'll never understand what you're worth.
Do you think he will?
Oh, I know he will.
They arrived at the manse, and Alyssa spoke with Margaret.
Have you seen Arlen this morning?
Yes, Mother. A few hours ago, spent some time with Maria, then left carrying a bag.
A bag?
Probably off to Harden's Grove, or some such.
Alyssa nodded, not surprised that Arlen had chosen to leave town for a day or two.
He'll be gone through tomorrow, at least. Come and see the baby before you go.
They headed upstairs. Alyssa cooed as she approached Maria's nest, eager to hold her daughter. But she stopped short when she saw the folded paper tucked partially beneath the baby. Her hands shaking, Alyssa lifted the scrap of parchment.
Dear Alyssa and Regan, I have taken assignment to Lacton from the Messengers Guild. By the time you read this, I will be on the road. I'm sorry I could not be what everyone wanted. Thank you for everything. I will never forget you. Arlen!
No!
Mary turned and fled the room, leaving the house at a run.
Regan! Regan!
Her husband came rushing to her side, and he shook his head sadly as he read the note.
Always running from his problems.
Well?
Well, what?
Go and find him! Bring him back!
Regan fixed his wife with a stern look, and without a word spoken, they argued. Alyssa knew it was a losing battle from the start, and soon lowered her eyes.
Too soon. Why couldn't he have waited one more day?
Arlen! Arlen!
All pretense of calm had flown from Mary. All interest in seeming strong, in making Arlen fight.
Arlen!
All she wanted now was to find him before he left and tell him that she loved him and that she would continue loving him no matter what he chose to do. She reached the city gate in record time, but it was too late. The guards reported that he had left the city hours earlier. Mary knew in her heart he was not coming back. If she wanted him, she would have to go after him. She knew how to ride. She could get a horse from Reagan and ride after him. He would surely succor in Hardin's Grove the first night. If she hurried, she could get there in time. She sprinted back to the manse, terror at the thought of losing him giving her fresh strength.
He's gone! I need to borrow a horse!
It's past midday. You'll never make it in time. You'll get halfway there and the Corlings will tear you to pieces.
I don't care! I have to try!
She darted for the stables,
but
Reagan caught her fast. She beat at him, but he was stone, and nothing she did could loosen his grip. Suddenly, Mary understood what Arlen had meant when he said Milne was a prisoner. And she knew what it was like to feel diminished. It was late before Cobb found the simple letter, stuck in the ledger on his countertop. In it, Arlen apologized for leaving early, before his 7 years were up. He hoped Cobb could understand. Cobb read the letter again and again, memorizing every word and the meanings between the lines.
Creator Arlen, of course I understand. What are you doing, Arlen?
Torchlight flickered invitingly on the stone stairs leading down into the dark. The sun was dipping low, and it would take several minutes to get back to his camp. But the stairs called to him in a way he could not explain. Cobb and Reagan had warned him about this. The thought of treasures that might be found in ruins was too much for some messengers, and they took risks, stupid risks. Arlen knew he was one of these, but he could never resist exploring the lost dots on the map, as Tender Ronald had put it. The money he had made messaging paid for these excursions, sometimes taking him days from the nearest road. But for all his effort, he found only dregs. His thoughts flashed back to the pile of books from the old world that crumbled to dust when he tried to pick them up. The rusted blade that gashed his hand had infected so badly he felt his arm was on fire. The wine cellar that caved in and trapped him for 3 days until he dug himself out without a bottle to show for it. Ruin hunting never paid off, and one day, he knew, it would be the death of him.
Go back, have a bite, check your wards, get some rest. Now the night take you.
Arlen headed down the stairs. But for all his self-loathing, Arlen's heart pounded with excitement. He felt free and alive beyond anything Milne could offer. This was why he became a messenger. He reached the bottom of the stairs and dragged a sleeve across his sweating brow. Hot as it was hard to imagine that after sunset, the desert above would drop to near freezing temperatures. He moved along a gritty corridor of fitted stones, his torchlight dancing along the walls like shadow demons.
Are there shadow demons? That would be just my luck.
Arlen had learned much in the last 3 years, soaking up knowledge of other cultures and their struggles with the Corlings like a sponge. In the Andirian forest, he had spent weeks studying wood demons. In Lacton, he learned of boats beyond the small two-man canoes used in Tibbetts Brook, and paid for his curiosity about water demons with a puckered scar on his arm. He had been lucky, able to plant his feet and haul on the tentacle, dragging the Corling from the water. Unable to abide the air, the nightmarish creature had let go and slipped beneath the surface once more. He spent months there, learning water wards. Fort Risen was much like home, less a city than a cluster of farming communities, each helping one another to ease the inevitable losses to Corlings who bypassed the ward posts. But Fort Crasia, the desert spear, was Arlen's favorite. Crasia of the stinging wind, where the days burned and the cold nights brought forth sand demons from the dunes. Crasia, where they still fought. The men of Fort Crasia had not allowed themselves to succumb to despair. They waged a nightly battle against the Corlings, locking away their wives and children and taking up spear and net. Their weapons, like those Arlen carried, could do little to pierce the tough skin of a Corling, but they stung the demons and were enough to harass them into warded traps until the desert sun rose to reduce them to ashes. Their determination was an inspiration. But for all he had learned, Arlen only hungered for more. Every city had taught him something unknown in the others. Somewhere out there had to be the answers he sought. And so, this latest ruin. Half buried in sand, almost forgotten, save for a crumbling Crasian map Arlen had discovered, the city of Anuk's Sun had stood untouched for hundreds of years. Much of the surface was collapsed or worn down by wind and sand, but the lower levels, cut deep into the ground, were intact. Arlen turned a corner and his breath caught. Up ahead, in the dim flickering light, he saw pitted symbols cut into the stone pillars to either side of the corridor.
Wards?
Holding the torch close, Arlen inspected them. They were old, ancient. The very air about them was stale with the weight of centuries. He took paper and charcoal from his satchel to make rubbings. Then, swallowing hard, continued on, lightly stirring the dust of ages. He came to a stone door at the end of the hall. It was painted with faded and chipped wards, few of which Arlen recognized. He pulled out his notebook and copied those intact enough to be made out, then moved to inspect the door. More a slab than a door, Arlen soon realized nothing held it in place save its own weight. Taking up his spear to use as a lever, he wedged the metal tip into the seam between the slab and the wall.
That night!
This far from Milne, metal was rare and expensive. Replacing the spear would be no small thing. Refusing to balk, Arlen took a hammer and chisel from his pack and hacked at the wall itself. The sandstone cut easily, and soon he had carved a nook wide enough to work the shaft of his spear into the room beyond. The stone resisted, but Arlen persevered. Finally, the slab toppled to the ground, leaving a narrow gap in the wall, choked with dust. Arlen moved into what appeared to be a burial chamber. It reeked of age, but already fresher air was flooding the room from the corridor. Holding up his torch, he saw that the walls were brightly painted with tiny stylized figures depicting countless battles of humans against demons, battles that the humans seemed to be winning. In the center of the room stood an obsidian coffin, cut roughly in the shape of a man holding a spear. Arlen approached the coffin, noting the wards along its length. He reached out to touch them and realized his hands were shaking. He knew there was little time remaining before sunset, but Arlen could not have turned away now if all the demons in the core rose up against him. He moved to the head of the sarcophagus and pushed hard, forcing the lid down so that it would tilt to the floor without breaking. The wall was close behind him, and he braced a foot against it for leverage. Arlen paid the lid no mind, staring at the contents of the great coffin. The wrapped body inside was remarkably intact, but it could not hold his attention. All Arlen could see was the object clutched in its bandaged hands, a metal spear. Sliding the weapon reverently from the corpse's stubborn grasp, Arlen marveled at its lightness. It was 7 feet long from tip to tip, and the shaft was more than an inch in diameter. The point was still sharp enough to draw blood after so many years. The metal was unknown to Arlen, but that fact flew from his thoughts as he noted something else. The spear was warded. All along its silvery surface, the etchings ran, a level of craftsmanship unknown in modern times. The wards were unlike anything he had ever seen. As Arlen became aware of the enormity of his find, he realized, too, the danger he was in. The sun was setting above. Nothing he had found here would matter if he died before bringing it back to civilization. Snatching up his torch, Arlen bolted out of the burial chamber and sprinted down the hall, taking the steps three at a time. He darted through the maze of passages on instinct, praying that his twists and turns were true. Finally, he saw the exit to the dusty, half-buried streets, but not a sliver of light could be seen through the doorway. As he reached the exit, he saw that the sky was still tinged with color. The sun had only just set. His camp was in sight, and the Corlings were just beginning to rise. Without pausing to consider his actions, Arlen dropped his torch and charged out of the building, scattering the sand as he zigzagged around the rising sand dunes. Cousins to rock demons, sand demons were smaller and more nimble, but still among the strongest and most armored of the Corling races. They had small, sharp scales, a dirty yellow almost indistinguishable from the grit, instead of the large charcoal gray plates of their rock demon cousins, and ran on all fours where rock demons stood hunched on two legs. But their faces were the same, rows of segmented teeth jutting out on their jaws like a snout, while their nostril slits rested far back, just below their large, lidless eyes. Thick bones from their brows curved upward and back, cutting through the scales as sharp horns. Their brows twitched continually as they squeezed down, displacing the ever-blowing sand. And even more frightening than their larger cousins, sand demons hunted in packs. They would work together to seem core. His heart pounding and his discovery forgotten, Arlen moved through the ruins with incredible speed and alacrity, vaulting fallen pillars and crumbled rock, while dodging right and left around the solidifying Corlings. Demons needed a moment to get their bearings on the surface, and Arlen took full advantage of that as he sprinted towards his circle. He kicked one demon in the back of the knees. Another he charged directly, only to spin out of the way at the last moment, the Corlings' claws slashing through empty air. He picked up speed as the circle neared, but one demon stood in his way, and there was no way around it. Arlen was so close, his precious circle a scant few feet away. He could only hope to barrel through the smaller creature and roll into his circle before it could kill him. He charged right in, instinctively stabbing with his new spear as he bowled the creature over. There was a flash upon impact, and Arlen struck the ground hard, coming up in a spray of sand and continuing on, not daring to look back. He leapt for his circle and was safe. Arlen looked up at the sand dunes surrounding him, outlined in desert twilight. In the flickering light, Arlen caught sight of the demon he'd crashed into. It was slowly dragging itself away from Arlen and its fellows, leaving an inky black trail in the sand. Arlen's eyes widened. Slowly, he glanced down at the spear he still clutched in his hand. The tip was coated in demon ichor. Suppressing the urge to laugh aloud, Arlen looked back at the injured corpse. One by one, its fellows paused in their assault on Arlen's wards, sniffing the air. They turned, glancing down at the trail of ichor, and then at the injured demon. The pack fell upon the creature, tearing it apart.